From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The revolving door at the White House keeps turning. The president's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, said yesterday he's resigning. He's been at odds with President Trump's plan to tax global imports of steel and aluminum. The president is expected to make those tariffs official, though, by the end of the week.
Let's take a look at the week so far. A deeper look with our political analyst this week, Alice Stewart, the Republican, the former communications director for the Ted Cruz presidential campaign. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Jeremy, how are you?
Good.
Doing well.
And Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democrat and spokeswoman for MoveOn.org. Hi, Karine.
Hey there. Good afternoon.
And Alice, I want to start with you. Gary Cohn's resignation, not totally a surprise. He's pro-trade. He's a Democrat. He was a dissenting voice on President Trump's tariffs plan. So not a huge surprise there. But are you worried as a Republican strategist about it adding to this image of, as Jeremy said, the revolving door, the Dow dropping, this image of chaos, instability? You concerned?
I think we all knew this was going to be how the Trump administration was going to operate. And look, Gary Cohn was instrumental in helping to get tax reforms passed, regulatory rollbacks. I was involved in many roundtables he oversaw at the White House to get the message out and help craft tax reform, which was very critical and I think a huge success for this administration. But as you said, he's been looking to leave for quite some time. He was upset with the president pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, obviously not happy with his response to Charlottesville. But this tariff was too much. It was a bridge too far. And he couldn't, in all conscience and in his experience and background, he couldn't be the lead salesman on a plan that he didn't agree with. Yeah. And I think we knew this was going to come. But on the heels of all of the turnover and turmoil in the White House, it's a lot. But as the president said, he thrives on conflict. That's how he ran his businesses. That's how he ran his campaign. That's how he runs his White House. Speaking with many Republicans out there across the country, they don't care about the palace intrigue. They want to see more tax cuts. They want to see jobs. And they don't get bogged down in what we're talking about with regards to the turmoil in the White House, which I think it's a stumbling block. It makes it difficult to get things done. But Trump's base, they expected this, and they're not fazed by it.
Karine, how does this look from your perspective as a Democrat?
I think the chaos and dysfunction has real-life consequences. It's not just about palace intrigue, excuse me. When you've had such a turnover like this president has had, two chiefs of staff, three deputy chiefs of staff, four communications director, two FBI directors, and countless other staffs in 13 months, which is unheard of. So you have a president who is historically unpopular for a modern-day president, and then you have this historical number, actually, of high turnover that we more than President Obama had and other presidents as well. And so it is just kind of this word that I'm going to use that I thought we buried in 2016, but clearly have not, which is unprecedented what we're seeing. And there is this, you know, there's this sense that people around Donald Trump say, oh, you know what? He's a political disruptor. What he does. He comes in. But the truth is he's disruptive.
Well, I was going to say to Alice's point, though, this is when we were out on the campaign trail. This is what voters wanted. They wanted a disruptor. And so they may be, his base may still be saying, we want this. But he's also disrupting the party with the push for tariffs. And we want to listen to some of the response. You know, there's the criticism that the president, wants to punish China for flooding the U.S. market with steel, but he's punishing Brazil, Canada, our allies who also sell steel, American workers. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan trying to say that yesterday.
Every now and then, we're just going to have a different approach on how we should tackle these problems. But it should be acknowledged that there is a problem that needs to be addressed here. We just want to make sure that it's done in a prudent way that's more surgical so we can limit unintended consequences.
And Senator Lindsey Graham was a little more pointed on Face the Nation.
China is winning and we're losing with this tariff regime. You're letting China off the hook. You're punishing the American consumer and our allies. You're making a huge mistake here. Go after China, not the rest of the world.
Alice Stewart, you're the Republican strategist. What's happening within the Republican Party? Are people afraid that if the president goes through with this tariff thing, it's going to be disaster, a trade war, American workers actually hurt?
It depends on how he executes this. I'm really not convinced he has a fully thought-out plan on how to execute these tariffs. He is following through on a campaign promise that he said he would do all he could to help steel workers in Pennsylvania and certainly the aluminum industry. But at the end of the day, when you crunch the numbers, while this talk is music to the ears of those in this industry, this virtually saves about $140,000 steel manufacturing jobs. But the impact throughout those who actually use steel and aluminum, we're putting at risk 5 million jobs.
Right.
And
people who make motorcycles.
Certainly. And when you really look at the numbers and the long-term impact, I would like to think the president will roll back some of this rhetoric, but it remains to be seen. We have not seen a full-scale plan, and this is similar to the immigration ban that he did with regard to bringing immigrants into this country. He didn't, the travel ban, he didn't have a fully thought out plan when he rolled this out. I would like to think he will scale this back. But with regard to the voters and the GOP base that I talk to, the volume of this chaos, there is so much of this. It's almost like white noise. The White House chaos is like white noise. And the conflict that some of them knew they were going to get, it's like comfort food for them. They knew this is what they were going to get, and they are fine. When they hear the president say, I like conflict, tariffs are good, that's what they hear. Well, they listen to all of this other stuff, but what they hear is what the president says.
Corrine, what about the Democrats? Where do they stand on this? It seems like there's a bit of division within the party about whether tariffs are a good idea. Like somebody like Bernie Sanders actually probably agrees with President Trump on this.
Well, I think it's the process, right? I think that, yeah, there's some ways to really talk about tariffs and trade in a way that is productive, in a way that is not done the way that Donald Trump did it, which is incredibly reckless. I mean, when you have a president who doesn't even talk to his own people, his senior staff, the folks that he put in leadership in the different agencies to say, okay, let's sit down, let's figure out how we make sure we do this without angering our allies, without the fact that this would tax our working people, the very people who put him into office. And it's the process. It's doing it the right way, putting forth policies that make sense, that doesn't anger everyone, including our important allies that we need, that we've already isolated ourselves because of the way Donald Trump has just behaved.
So are you saying you're against the tariffs or you're pro tariffs?
Oh, I'm against the tariff. Okay. You were asking me a question about some Democrats who are for this, and I was saying that the process here is not working. I'm not for this at all.
Well, I just want to make sure that we get to porn star Stormy Daniels.
Oh gosh.
Well, because it's these things that people think, oh, it's just the stuff of tabloids, and then suddenly you have a blue dress that, you know, leads to an impeachment. Look, this is the porn star and director Stormy Daniels, who filed a lawsuit against the president. She wants to nullify the non-disclosure agreement she signed before the 2016 election. It was that she would not disclose about her alleged affair and then platonic friendship with the president. She wants it nullified because her lawyer says the president didn't sign it, and she wants to be able to go public with this alleged affair. Alice, how concerned should the White House be?
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for going through. There are two avenues. There's the political ramifications, potentially using campaign funds to pay off hush money to a porn dud. And there's the personal conflict with this, is being tied up with someone like this. I can say with all honesty, Robin and Jeremy and Corrine, I have never pursued a career in the adult film industry. However, I would imagine those people are motivated more by money than morality. And when she's looking at the end of the day, why is she so concerned about violating a confidentiality agreement? Why doesn't she just say, forget the $130,000 hush money and just go sell her story and tell all? I don't understand why she's dragging this out. If she has a story to tell,
Once you've taken the money legally, you can't do it. So she's trying to say that the contract wasn't legal.
Right. And it appears if the president didn't sign it, then I think she is on firm legal ground. I think bigger picture for the president, this is another potential. This is another problem when we're talking about people, unsavory characters, and bigger than the personal aspect and the shady nature of it, there's a potential legal jeopardy with regard to using campaign funds to pay her off.
Okay. We're going to give you each 30 seconds here, but I want to hear your thoughts on the primary in Texas. Big Democratic turnout, even bigger Republican turnout. Corrine, start with you. What do you think? What does it tell you?
You know, I think that it's a good sign. It's one of those things, those catch-22, because it's like we saw very high turnout amongst Dems. We saw progressives win. We saw women win. I think we're going to send Texas is going to send some women to Congress, which is incredibly historical and wonderful. But we saw Texas continue to trend more blue, but we're not there yet.
Right.
And so I think that's where it is. It's kind of, you know, catch-22. Right. Good news but some real news as well.
Okay, Alice, just brief response. Go ahead.
Sure. Full disclosure, I was Ted Cruz's communications director on the presidential campaign, and I think Texas is a red state. It will be red in the general, and he has good money in the bank. He's got the right message. He's served the people of Texas well, and certainly has worked really hard throughout his time there.
A little campaigning there.
that being said, I applaud the Democrats for coming out. I applaud them for getting folks out and turning voters out.
Yep.
At the end of the day, though, Beto O'Rourke, while he may be a fine candidate, he's in the wrong state.
We have to leave it there. Karine Jean-Pierre, the Democratic analyst. Alice Stewart, the Republican. The threat of deportation is growing for many immigrant families. Just ask the Macarios of Lynn, Massachusetts. 2 years ago, they said goodbye to their father when he was deported back to his native Guatemala after losing an asylum case. Last week, Isidro Macario, the eldest son who came to the U.S. illegally when he was 13 to join his parents, was accompanied by immigration officers at Boston's Logan Airport as he was sent back to Guatemala. Left behind, his three younger brothers, all U.S.-born citizens, and his mom, who's in sanctuary to avoid deportation. Shannon Dooling from member station WBUR met with the family just before Isidro was deported.
Erwin, Anthony, and so on.
The Macario brothers, four of them in all, are looking at old school photos hanging on the wall in their apartment in Lynn, Massachusetts. They're poking fun at the haircut their dad gave one of them back in the third grade.
It was like a bowl cut.
There's a plastic pitcher of pink Kool-Aid on the kitchen table and a Bible sitting on top of the microwave. The youngest brothers come out of their room one by one. 21-year-old Erwin, 18-year-old Anthony, and 16-year-old Saul. They all know this could be one of their last nights together with their eldest brother, 27-year-old Isidro, who, after several years fighting his removal from the U.S., has run out of options.
You know, it didn't start yesterday. It's been going on for almost 8 years straight.
Isidro Macario says worrying about the future is just part of life for his family. They're accustomed to receiving regular doses of anxiety, letters from the Department of Homeland Security that seem to always come around Christmas time.
I remember most of the time we are in the living room receiving letters saying that our parents have to leave the country. And instead of, you know, having a table ready for the family, we get these letters or bad news. It always happens, so...
Isidro Macario has applied for different legal statuses, but criminal charges stemming from what his lawyer calls a trumped-up statutory rape allegation stood in his way. Those charges were dismissed in 2013, according to court documents, and he has no criminal convictions. He's the oldest brother, and after his father was deported back to Guatemala, he doubles as a parent to his younger brothers.
Por mi familia. Yo no los quiero dejar.
I'm here for my family. I don't want to leave my sons.
That's their mother, Marida. She's in the U.S. without documentation and has a pending immigration case. For nearly 2 months, she's been sheltered in a church in Greater Boston. She says she misses her sons, but the church is her safest option.
Yo estoy triste, pero a la vez estoy contenta porque estoy en buena familia, en buenas manos.
I'm sad, but I'm also content here, and I'm in good hands.
This type of family upheaval is becoming more common, say immigration advocates, especially in families like the Macarios, where different members hold different immigration statuses.
For example, an undocumented mom with two citizen children and a husband who has, let's say, TPS.
That's Ava Malona, director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. There are nearly 1 million foreign-born residents in the state. Half of them are naturalized citizens.
It's a huge concern emotionally, but also practically, because, you know, these individuals are part of the workforce, they're consumers, so it's really, really problematic and widespread.
For many immigrants, President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement priorities have created cavernous unknowns. At least, that's what it feels like to 16-year-old Saul Macario.
When I see it taking them one by one, that's how I see it. The first it was my dad, then my mom, my brother.
With the hood of his sweatshirt pulled down low over his forehead and his hair just slightly in his eyes, 21-year-old Erwin Macario says he's been thinking a lot about what it means to now be the oldest in the family.
It's a lot to take in, to take care of my little brothers. It's going to be a lot of responsibility, but at the same time, it's going to help me mature. And if anything, you know, I got them, and I'm going to push through just for them.
Erwin Macario says he can always get a second job to help make up for the missing income and keep what's left of the family intact. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Now to Broward County, Florida, where 17 people were killed in the attack on Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. The school board passed a resolution this week calling on Congress to ban assault weapons, require universal background checks, and expand school gun-free zones. They dismissed the idea of arming teachers. Many of the solutions that others, including President Trump, have reached in thinking of ways to deal with school shootings are about school hardening, more security, more people who are armed. But is there a danger in turning schools into prisons for the sake of safety? For more, we're joined by Pedro Noguera. He's a professor of education at UCLA and director of the Center for the Transformation of Schools. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And make your case for us. What is the danger in hardening schools?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, the purpose of school is to create an environment where kids can learn, where they are able to develop and explore and hopefully to grow. And you don't do that in an unsafe atmosphere, for sure, but you also don't do it in an atmosphere that where there's a hyper sense of security. Security tends to actually make us feel more stressed and less able to relax when there are people around with guns who are patrolling. So I think it's something we need to be very careful about. The real work we need to do has to take place in our society to make our society safer than it is right now.
Well, what do you mean by that? How do you make the society safer? You're just talking about gun laws or what?
If you think about the social contract on which safety is premised, right, that the idea is that we're not safe simply because we have police officers with guns. We're safe because people respect the laws. We're safe because we respect each other. And we need to find ways to reinforce those bonds of solidarity in our society that allow us to live a safe and comfortable life. And if we don't have that, if we live in a society where there are too many people who are alienated and estranged and where so many people have access to weapons, then we find that all of us are vulnerable, whether we're at school or at church or at a movie theater. And so we need to really figure out what are we going to do to not only reduce the availability of guns, but to strengthen the bonds that keep society safe and maintain a civil level of social relationships.
You make the connection to inner city schools, that we're talking about this now in schools in maybe suburban areas, more majority white population, but that this is something that schools with a majority population of people of color have been dealing with for a long time.
That's right. And in urban schools, it tends to be that the nature of violence is different. It tends to be that there are concerns about safety coming from the neighborhood. But it also tends to be that when there are violent incidents in schools, they're rarely random. They're rarely someone just shooting up everyone. Rather, it's individuals who have conflict with one another, engaging in violence. And so there's a different nature. And so you have to take different precautions to address those kinds of problems.
And does it make a difference in those schools to have had, for example, metal detectors to get through the doors?
Metal detectors actually are very ineffective because if you just think about it, there's so many other ways to get a weapon into a school other than going through the front door. So again, if you're just relying on security, you're not going to really keep a school safe. If kids know and trust the adults, they'll let you know if a problem is brewing. They'll let you know if a child, another student has a weapon on them.
I think back to my high school experience, and I was in high school when Columbine happened. But our school was very proud of being very open. And in fact, people didn't even lock their lockers. It's kind of unusual, but there is a benefit, isn't there, to that feeling of freedom and openness in a school?
There is a benefit to those feelings. And I think that we don't want to lose that. We don't want to, in the name of security, turn our schools into prisons. I like to point out to people, prisons are not safe places. So why would that be the model? Safety, as I said, is a product of relationships. It's when we know each other, when we're looking out for each other, when students feel connected, that schools are ultimately safer. And that's what we need to invest in. Money is right now that we're investing in metal detectors and security guards would be better spent on counselors and social workers and psychologists, the people who can serve as a resource to children. Again, it's not to say there aren't times when more security is needed. But I think if that's the only thing we rely on, we will find ourselves really damaging the learning environment for many of our kids.
After the Newtown attack, they had to rebuild the school at Sandy Hook, and they did it keeping in mind that they wanted it to have a feeling of openness. Is there a school that you can think of that's doing things right?
Oh, I could think of many, many schools like that, and including schools that are in very challenging neighborhoods. And again, it's because of the time spent building relationships. I work with a school like that in Los Angeles now. It's surrounded by gangs. It's in a very poor community. They haven't had a fight at the school in 7 years. But they spend the first day of school just building relationships. And what I've heard from the teachers there is that students will approach them and let them know when there are problems because they've taken time to build the relationship and establish some trust. And so while it might seem trite, the fact is that trust and strong relationships are a security measure.
That's Pedro Noguera, who's a professor of education at UCLA and director of the Center for the Transformation of Schools. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The price of oil now hovers above $60 a barrel. And while that high price would have once spelled trouble for the U.S. economy, now, thanks to domestic oil production, it's a little more complicated. Robin Farzad hosts the podcast Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hello, Robin with an E.
How are you? You can call me McLovin. It's my middle name.
Okay. Well, I'm Robin with an I. The U.S. now produces as much oil as it did in the early 70s and sells it. So more global oil revenues coming back to U.S. producers like Exxon and Shell. But now that more of that oil comes from here, as opposed to, say, Saudi Arabia, is the rest of the U.S. economy, you know, benefiting?
It's funny, Robin. You know, I'm old enough to remember when CNN would call me on when oil would go above $25 a barrel.
Right.
And we've since had to adapt to a broader band of volatility. Oil, you'll recall, shot up to $140
right.
a decade ago, and that gave rise to a renaissance in U.S. drilling and boom towns in places like North Dakota. But when prices crashed a few years ago, Wall Street started worrying that some of these upstarts couldn't survive. So the story now, the equilibrium is not too low, not too high, is best for the economy.
Well, but, you know, you are telling us also that there's industry around this. So there's manufacturing, there's drilling or what, however you get oil. So that does benefit. You know, there's work here because of oil production. But I'm wondering if costlier oil, while, you know, it might help those spots that are now producing it, drilling it, might raise prices on things in the U.S. made with oil.
you know, we constantly test that in real time. You feel it most immediately at the pump. If you recall, $4 gasoline in some parts back in 2008, and the roar back to gas guzzlers when gas then fell below $2 again. You see it in plastics and raw material prices. They're correlated to petroleum swings. The question for me is, are higher prices simultaneously stoking innovation in fuel economy? I'll give you an example. Subaru is coming out with its biggest SUV ever. It'll have a ton of room and good horsepower, and yet it will run on a four-cylinder engine that also gets decent fuel economy. But you know that whatever the price of oil, the push to electric vehicles and alternatives, I mean, that ship's already sailing.
By the way, if there's a trade war because of the president's push for tariffs, would that jeopardize overseas sales of U.S. oil?
You know, I think oil is a different beast. It's highly fungible. It makes its way into markets often despite sanctions. I think you're more likely to see other economies retaliate elsewhere, especially as the U.S. has more energy self-determination right now.
Okay. And you know, while we have you as well, Gary Cohn resigning from his position as White House economic advisor. You know, he was trying to persuade the president not to roll out his tariff plan. How did the markets open coming off of this news, and why is the opening so important?
We like to gauge reaction at the open. There's a lot of pent-up demand. The news came out last night. I mean, look, it was a down day in the markets, and the morning was the morning. But don't forget, this is a Goldman Sachs guy who just joined the wrong White House. There's legit trepidation over Trump and tariff fever, but, you know, markets going to mark.
Well, I was just going to say, are markets, though, maybe worried that, yeah, he was an anti-tariff Democrat, but he might have been a balance that's no longer there?
That balance wasn't working, apparently. I mean, that's been falling apart. Trump did decide on moving ahead with the tariffs after all.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, he hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One and visits us for all things on the economy. Robin, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Let's take a few minutes now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Corrine Daniel is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica and joins us once again. Hi, Corrine.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. And last time you were on, which was back in April, you said the sounds of the 70s were having a moment. Is anything having a moment now?
I think today we've got more of artists stepping out on their own. I think that's sort of the umbrella term that we can use as we go through these tracks today.
Going solo, these artists.
Yeah, I think so. So not too much of a sonic overlap, but something new for them and kind of making their own way. So I think that's sort of interesting.
Okay, the first one is Can't Catch Me. It's by Run Child Run. Run Child Run is the stage name for Ian Sims. Tell us about him and this song.
So Ian Sims has been working with a number of artists in the past. He's a multi-instrumentalist who's worked with Nicholas Jarre, Dave Harrington, Momo Ishiguro, a number of different artists, but decided to take this time out for himself and release an album. This album called Vanishing Point was out earlier this year, and I think it's a really interesting move for him. It's very meditative, pensive, and I think this single is kind of more fun, but there are other tracks that are meandering and kind of don't necessarily have a goal, but are just a nice place to kind of think about things, and it's a nice emotional album that way.
And the album is entirely self-produced. Is that unusual?
I think it speaks to just his talent, the ability to do the vocals himself and all of the instruments as well. I think it speaks to the amount of work that he's done in the past and is just gives him the opportunity to be very unique in what he produces. So
there's also kind of an eerie quality to it.
Totally. Hypnotic, minimal, meditative, but just very pensive, I think, too. If you look into some of the other tracks, they're just kind of slow moving, just feels very spacious.
Okay, next, you've brought us British musician Holly Cook with Ghostly Fading.
Trying to find.
Obviously a strong reggae influence there, which is something that was also present in her previous group, The Slits.
That's right. I'm glad you mentioned that. All-female punk reggae band, The Slits. So she's kind of staying close to her roots, but it's definitely a more polished version of her sound and not too different from her last album called Twice, which came out a couple of years ago. So it's very similar to what she's done before. It's just a little bit dreamier and just kind of goes through the whimsy of being totally in your own world and just floating all the time. I think she's really captured that emotion in this album. And so I think that's really the takeaway for me here, is just the idea of escaping into the fantasy of romance.
Okay, up next we've got Tea-Soaked Letter. This is by the Detroit-based Anna Birch. Now, Anna Birch is of the band Failed Flowers. This is her solo debut. Tell us more about her.
Yeah, so now for something a little bit different than the dreamy sounds of Holly Cook. What I like about Anna Birch, so now she's also stepping out on her own. She, like you mentioned, worked with Failed Flowers, was also singing in Frontier Ruckus for a while, but now really wanted to take some time off and do something for herself. And this album kind of is a little bit more, I think she calls it bummer pop. Huh. So it sounds kind of sweet. Lyrics are a little bit not that sweet. So just an interesting emotional diptych.
You know, I feel at this point like there are almost as many genres as band names. The bummer pop, I've never even heard of that before, but I guess she says that's where she fits.
Yeah, things just have gotten so complicated that I do feel like I'm showing my age now. I heard someone say Fraser Wave. So if anyone wants to
like the
look into
Fraser?
That, it's out there. That's right, yeah.
Wow.
So there's a lot out there. It's good to explore.
Okay, next you brought us the Afro-Latin band Pena with Search It Out, parentheses, Reboot. Afro-Latin, what influences are you hearing here?
So I guess they draw influences from music from Cuba, Turkey, Morocco, India, Peru, Tanzania. So really it seems like a global mix of music that they're drawing from. And also led by producer and multi-instrumentalist, again, his name is called Magnum P.I. And this is their debut album that just was released on the Corner Records. So really drawing from a global set of influences here, but creating something that just feels so buoyant and happy and lively, and it just always puts me in a good mood.
And there's kind of a video game quality to it as well.
Totally, totally. I think part of it is the percussive elements, and then just some of the other instruments as well are just so bright and pop. And I think they're really good at doing that, is making everything kind of stick out so vibrantly in a way that feels very emotive.
Okay, finally, you have brought us Good Luck. You've brought us Good Luck, of course, just by being here, but you've brought us a song called Good Luck by Myrna. Here it is.
Good luck, loving somebody like me. Who's gonna keep you around? Run you right back into the ground with good luck, finding somebody.
What a voice.
Yeah, isn't it stunning? Really, really impressed by this band. They've been around for a number of years, but I could only find a few tracks by them. But they were recently signed to Native Cat Recordings, and they'll be releasing a full-length EP. Her voice is just so compelling and unique, and I just feel like there's so much room for them to make a splash with this full-length. So I'm really looking forward to it, so it should be coming out later this year.
And how did you discover Myrna?
Sure. Just looking through different bands, just searching the web. It's not the most romantic story, but a couple of other venues have also picked them up. So I think they're a band that is on their way into becoming a lot bigger, so I'd really just keep my finger on the pulse with what they're going to come out with as far as the full length.
Okay, well, listeners, you heard it here first. Myrna, let's see what happens. Corinne Daniel, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. This is great.
There's lots of intrigue in the world of Russian spycraft. Today, British police said the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter were poisoned by a nerve agent. The two were found slumped on a bench in the UK on Sunday and are critically ill. He was convicted in Russia of spying for Britain in 2006 and has been living in the UK after a dramatic prisoner swap in 2010. Meanwhile, that high-end escort, Anastasia Vasukevich, in prison in Thailand for working at a sex training seminar without a visa, says she has recordings that could aid the investigation of Russian meddling in the U.S. election. David Filipov is a former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. David, start with Skripal. Russia denies any involvement in his illness, but he would not be the first person to cross the Kremlin and maybe end up dead in England. So people are naturally thinking, that's got to be what it is.
Right. That's the thing, Robin. With every one of these allegations, I mean, just listening to you describe it, it sounds so outrageous and so much like a James Bond novel, right?
Or The Americans.
Oh, The Americans. You know, it sounds crazy. But the reason that anyone's even giving it any credence is because in 2006, a former Russian spy who was critical of Vladimir Putin did mysteriously end up poisoned with a radioactive substance. And in absentia, Britain decided that those were Russian spies who did it. So when a former spy suddenly ends up critically ill mysteriously, naturally we assume this is it again. Now, of course, the Kremlin's going to deny it because you would never acknowledge, hey, we did try to assassinate our guy. Also, this is would be a really serious violation of the rules of spycraft because Sergei Skripal was exchanged for, you may remember, the 10 spies who were caught here in the United States.
They were the Americans.
Yeah, the Americans. It was a prisoner exchange. Remember Anna Chapman? She did centerfolds later. I mean, it was a prisoner exchange. That would be a complete violation of the unwritten rules of spycraft. Once you exchange the spies, you don't go back and, you know, assassinate them. So the Kremlin's denying it. They're denying involvement. There's also the total possibility that two people got poisoned by something else.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll leave that aside because you actually say, as disturbing as that is, that these two people are sick. The more interesting one for you is this escort from Belarus. She goes by the name Nastya Rybka. She's currently in a Thai prison seeking asylum in the U.S. What does she claim to have?
Well, she's a fascinating story, too. We only know about her because she was sent by somebody to go and try to entrap Alexei Navalny, an opposition anti-corruption activist. He was trying to figure out who she was. Turns out on Instagram, she's posted lots of pictures of her posing on a yacht with a famous Russian oligarch who's involved in our Russia investigation, the meddling investigation, Oleg Deripaska. Our anti-corruption activist looks further. He finds out that she's written a tell-all book about her relationship with a Russian billionaire who turns out to be Oleg Deripaska, the guy who's involved in our investigation, the guy who had dealings with Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman.
Who is also a lobbyist who represented the Russian-backed president of Ukraine.
Who represented the president of Ukraine who fled to Russia. That's right. What we definitely know for sure. So all of this comes together, and now she ends up in a jail in Thailand. She says, I know that I heard Oleg Deripaska, with whom I was on yachts, talking to people who sounded like Americans about the U.S. election. So if you help me, if you get me political refugee status, I'll tell all.
Look, there are the pictures. She claims to have the audio. What are the chances that she's going to remain alive to do that? If she indeed has something, I mean...
Well, of course, what she's saying is that she's in great danger. I wouldn't be able to speculate about her chances of staying alive. I will say that what sounds so outlandish, and as I'm saying it, I sometimes question how serious I should take this. It's because we've seen the evidence, the breadcrumbs that she left on the internet, pictures of her with Oleg Deripaska. We know Oleg Deripaska is tied to Manafort. We know that Manafort is facing these serious charges. We know that the Mueller investigation is getting closer. So when she says, I have something that connects Deripaska with the Trump campaign, I mean, we have no choice but to listen to her, right?
Yeah. But by the way, you are here now. But what are people in Russia saying about these stories?
Okay. So when you and me say, we roll our eyes and we say, this sounds outlandish, but we got to take it seriously, they stop with, that's outlandish. You guys are reaching. You're out of your minds. What's wrong with you Americans? Move on. What's this big mass hysteria where suddenly everything and everybody is this huge campaign to, you know, mess with America? And in a way, you got to see their point. In fact, Putin is not all powerful. In fact, this Nastya Rybka case shows you how chaotic.
The escort, yeah.
You know, the escort case, it shows you how chaotic and messed up all of this stuff is. It is true that oligarchs and sex workers apparently meet on boats. And it is true that Manafort is in serious trouble. The Russians are saying, why do you connect all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, and it also is true, apparently, that she was sent to this opposition person to try to put him in a compromising position. Gee, who would have sent her to an opposition?
And that's the thing. That's why we have to take it seriously, because the Russians are saying, look, we're just serious people trying to do serious things. Why do you blame us for everything? And we say, well, who is it that sends sex workers to entrap opposition activists who are polling at 2%? Why even bother with them? Why go to that, you know, cartoonish attempt to try to keep down this opposition guy? Yeah. That's the thing that makes the Kremlin look bad.
And continues to intrigue us. David Filipov, former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.